This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. It's that time of year when just about everyone is thinking of vacation or wishing they could take a vacation. And my guest today, along with his wife of several decades, actually lived the secret dream of many American couples. Robert Mottram spent a year on the road traveling more than 30,000 miles into the four corners of America. He says he learned things about our country that probably most of us don't know. And along the way, he also learned about discovery and personal loss. For more than 40 years, Robert Mottram worked as a newspaper reporter, feature writer, columnist and editorial writer, and as an Associated Press newsman and correspondent. He's the recipient of more than 40 awards for reporting and writing, including two national Best of the Best awards for feature writing. Welcome, Robert Mottram. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Vicki. I'm happy to be here.
Very pleased to have you here because I think this is a very common dream of many people. They'd just like to take off and travel indefinitely. So before we get into that, I should say that the book you wrote about your travels is called In Search of America's Heartbeat, 12 Months on the Road.
Yes.
And I wanted just to take a little look, tell our listeners more about you, more about your wife, what kind of people you were, what kind of jobs you had. I know that you were obviously a journalist. Your wife was a nurse. You both lived in Tacoma.
Yes, I worked for quite a number of years for the News Tribune at Tacoma, the last 24 years as outdoor writer there. Prior to that, I worked for other newspapers, and I worked for the Associated Press, including tours in northern New England and Alaska and Seattle.
Mm. And your wife was a nurse. Now, you both were getting to retirement age, is that right?
We're both getting to retirement age. She was a public health nurse, worked for Tacoma Pierce County, and she handled diseases for the health department. Her job was to track down the sources of communicable diseases and figure out what they were and what was spreading them in any particular instance and find a way to stop them. And which she did very well.
Okay, well, good. We're glad about that. So you guys had obviously worked very hard all of your life. You had a grown son down in Oregon, a grown daughter up here in Seattle. What spurred this trip? And we should tell our listeners how you traveled. You decided that RV travel was going to be the way for you. How did you come to that decision? How did you start planning this and putting this together?
Well, I think it probably all began decades ago with John Steinbeck and Travels with Charlie. I read that book, as I recall, when I was in my 20s and never got over it. He traveled with his French poodle, Charlie, in a pickup camper, and he only spent about 4 months on the road, but he had the kind of adventures that Karen and I were looking for.
Yeah, I should do that with my border collie, Dylan. So tell us how long you planned this. I think I remember reading that it was a couple of years in the planning. Because
it was quite a while in the planning. We started talking casually about it, and as retirement loomed closer and closer, the talk became more and more urgent, and we finally spent several months searching for just the right RV. It turned out to be a 32-foot fifth-wheel trailer, which attaches to the bed of a pickup truck. We sold our smaller truck, our Japanese import, and we bought a big Dodge diesel to haul the fifth wheel. We started out. I wanted to do just what Steinbeck did and travel by pickup camper. And Karen, Karen told me, no way, and in bleep, am I going to spend a year of my life in a pickup camper? So that went right out the window.
And your idea in doing that was so that you could really get down the back roads and stop at local fairs and cookouts.
Exactly. We want to see how, I wanted to see particularly how people really live. And tourist sites were not on our agenda, except peripherally, and we wanted to go and meet Americans in their native habitat and see what made them tick.
Mm. So the thing that I liked, I mean, you very carefully planned. You had to, you know, you've got a lot to think of. I mean, you've got incoming mail, you've got your house, your car, you had a boat. What do you do with all this stuff?
Exactly.
You've got bills to pay even though you're not there. So you spent a meticulous amount of time getting that all organized. And yet when you left, you said you left with no agenda.
Exactly. So, we had only the vaguest idea. We're going to follow the weather. We left in August, and we started south. And we dawdled. We took our time because we didn't want to get too far south too fast while it was still too hot. But we headed south and into California and Nevada, and then across the southern part of the United States through the winter, ended up in Florida. We waited there for the arrival of spring, and we followed spring north through the Appalachians to northern New England and the Canadian Maritimes, and then we zigzagged back and forth across the country to the southwest again, and then back home. We wanted to get home before the snow arrived.
Mm. Now, I personally like traveling without an agenda, and I know probably this was one of the reasons you did it, because you've lived your life on deadlines, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Did you find that made it easier for you, or did it cause some issues at all?
You know, it was surprisingly easy. It wasn't real life. It was like a year long vacation, and we often encountered people in our trip who learned that we'd recently retired. They would ask us how we liked retirement, and we'd say, "Well, we don't know. We're on vacation, and when we get back to Washington, when this trip is over, we'll have to figure out what retirement is all about."
Mm.
And that was true. And we find, much to our own surprise, that here, where we live now in Anacortes, we need to have some structure in our lives, which we didn't think would be the case. But after living structured lives for so long, I guess we're like old fire horses. During the year on the road, we left it deliberately unstructured. We never planned specifically more than 24 hours ahead, like to arrange a place to stay. That would only be done a day ahead. And when we pulled into a place to camp, if we liked it, we might stay several days. We might stay several weeks.
Yeah, I think that's the way to travel, personally, if you have the option.
Yeah.
So I know that at the end of the book you say we set out to try to find America, and if we found it, to put our hands on its heart and see if we could feel the beat. Do you think you found the beat of America?
Well, I think we did, and what we found was, as the book also says, that America doesn't live, we discovered, the real America doesn't live in just one place. We were looking for that place, for the true heart of America, and we found that it lives in many places, and in different places, in every different region of the country, the beat of its heart has a different rhythm. But in each region of the country, that beat is just as strong and as powerful as you can imagine.
And you said, flipping back to the beginning of the book now, that, people so often today get their information from TV, and you made the comment that you might think a pall has settled over these United States if we listen to television anchors and some of the horrid reality shows that we have on television right now. And the questions you went out with, do they reflect America at large, its ordinary people? and you weren't sure then. What do you think about that now?
Well, we found that definitely did not reflect America at large. We learned that Americans everywhere we visited, from coast to coast and from one corner of the country to another, meet life with courage and more than that, they meet life with optimism.
Mm. And you said that what you found, I mean, given the situation, because we hear so much about, you know, recession and problems and people really struggling, but you said what you found does give us cause for hope and even celebration.
Well, I think so. I think so. We gained, Karen and I gained new respect for our country and for its people, and we developed a tremendous pride as a result of this trip, and in being tiny threads in a fabric that's so diverse and so tightly woven and so strong.
Mm. Now, so how many miles a day on average did you drive? I know that you said you promised your wife no 500-mile days.
Yeah,
did you keep to that?
I did. Yeah, believe it or not. And for the first time in my life, and the closest we got to that, I think the longest day of the trip, as I recall, the longest travel done in one day was 300 and some odd miles, and that was in the Midwest, going from someplace in Missouri to someplace in southeastern South Dakota. The shortest day we spent on the road was 2 miles.
Oh, really?
Really, and I was in Fort Myers, Florida, and it was necessary for us to move from one campground to another, and the trip was a total of 2 miles. We averaged, and I forget what the figures are. I've got them in the book. We averaged 30, 40 miles a day. If we had traveled every day, that's what it would work out. And in a typical day, we would travel only 150 or 200 miles on a day when we traveled at all.
Mm. Let's talk about some of the challenges that we have. Weird little echo going on there. Let's talk about some of the challenges that you had moving place to place on a daily basis. I know one of them you talked about, and maybe you didn't see this as a challenge, but every supermarket you go into, even if it's the same, even if it's the same chain, is laid out differently. And I remember when I emigrated to America, that was one of my biggest frustrations. I could not just run into a supermarket and grab something. Because all the brands were different, the names, you know, we call pantyhose tights. People didn't know what I was asking for. What were some of the challenges that you ran into?
Well, that was one of them. The fact that every place we shopped, we were strangers. And so we'd go into a store and we developed a technique. Karen would, I would grab a basket and start sweeping the aisles, up one aisle, down another, and Karen would head directly for the customer service counter and apply for one of their preferred customer cards, and then meet me somewhere among the canned goods, and we'd continue to shop. And then we ended up with a glove compartment full of these cards, many of them from stores you never even knew existed, but they all have these cards, and so we'd shop with strangers and run back and forth to find the things we needed. That was one of the problems. Another problem was trying to find an adequate campground. Sometimes we really struck it rich, and we found some beautiful places to stay. And other times, not so good. The campground would be a little disappointing or immediate environment. One of the greatest things, though, about the trip, about traveling in a fifth wheel or any kind of an RV, you're on the road and you're finding adventure, and undergoing new experiences. But you're sleeping in your own bed and you're eating your own cooking if you wish, and so you're at home and traveling at the same time, and we would awaken in the morning and throw up the curtain on the window and outside the window, there might be a fir tree, there might be a palm tree, there might be a blue lagoon, or it might be a saguaro cactus. And we'd enjoy it from the familiarity of our own room.
Yeah, there were a lot of pluses doing it that way. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'd like to ask Robert about some of his favorite places and some of his least favorite places and experiences along the way. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. Life I love is making music with my friends. I can't wait to get on the road again.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
In the desert, you can't remember your name, 'cause there ain't no one for to give you no pain.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, naturalist, adventurer, and essayist Craig Childs. People magazine describes his new book as a quietly seductive ode to the power of mindfulness. And the New York Times Book Review declares Childs a modern-day desert father who responds to nature with religious awe. Tune in next Monday at noon for the Animal Dialogues, Uncommon Encounters in the Wild, right here on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. You can find more show details at conversationslive.net.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Get current weather, traffic, and news. Visit 1150kknw.com and stay informed with Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. We're having a little gremlin in here today, don't we? Do we have a loose wire somewhere? What's going on, Eric?
I don't know. Is it Mercury in retrograde, or is that done? I don't remember, but just had a little issue with the music not playing.
All right. Well, I'm not singing, so
I think we got it together. That's what I was pointing at you. I was saying, start singing on the road again. I'm sure you have a lovely singing voice.
Yeah, I quite like the sunshine. It's going to rain if I start singing, so we'll leave me stum. All right, so you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we are talking today with award-winning journalist Robert Mottram, and he, along with his wife, spent 12 months traveling to the four corners of America, trying to find the heartbeat of America and its people. And his book is called In Search of America's Heartbeat, 12 Months on the Road. Robert, there's a stunning photograph on the book jacket. Where is that?
That was taken in the Great Smoky Mountains. As I recall, that's standing in Tennessee and looking into North Carolina. I happened to take that photo as we were crossing Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
Yeah, it just is a beautiful photograph, and it has a road winding through the hills, the kind of road you just want to travel and follow. Did you actually go along that road?
Yes, we did. And it's just the kind of road I saw in my dreams, before the trip when we were getting ready to go. It's the kind of a road I was looking for, and there it was.
Mm. So you say that you learn things about America that most of us probably don't know. When you tell stories of your travels to people, what's the one thing that surprises most people, you know, where they say, wow, I didn't know that?
Well, my goodness, there are a number of things. The wilderness, for example, that exists in northeastern New York State. New Yorkers claim it's the largest protected wilderness in the eastern U.S., and it in fact, it's larger than the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's the Adirondack State Forest Preserve.
Oh, see, I'm going to say, wow, I didn't know that.
Another little factoid the fact that Key West, Florida, seceded from the United States not too long ago. I'm not sure anybody noticed, but they declared war on the U.S., seceded and declared war, and then surrendered, of course, and asked for foreign aid. And they're still waiting for the money. But they describe themselves as the people who seceded where others failed.
Really?
Yeah. And the people of New Hampshire who are so suspicious of government power that they keep their governor on a very short leash. They elect him, for example, for only 2 years at a time instead of the usual four, because they don't want him to get the bit in his teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And they divide the executive branch of government into two parts. Now most governments in the U.S. have three parts. They have the executive, the judicial, and the legislative. And the people of New Hampshire have those three parts also, but they further subdivide the executive branch into two parts and make the governor share his power with a five-person executive council that must endorse every action the governor takes, or it's not official.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And this goes back, of course, to the bad experience the people of New Hampshire had with George III.
Uh-huh.
And they still haven't forgotten that experience.
Well, that was just a few years ago, right?
Yes.
Now, you talk also about personal prejudices, which we all have. I mean, we all, you know, picture certain places to be one way in our own mind's eye, even if we've never been there. And you talked about, let's, for example, say Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and you admitted to being surprised that people, as you crossed over there, were driving nice cars and actually had teeth in their mouths. So
yeah.
what were you expecting, and well, what did you ultimately find?
Yeah, the first time I went through there, I was surprised to see nice cars and people with most of their teeth, if not all of them. But more than being surprised at that, I was surprised that I was surprised. I had never realized that I apparently carried this prejudice about Mississippi, never having had been there, and it served as a sort of a warning and a lesson to me that sometimes we have these preconceptions we don't even know about. And so the second time I went through, which was on this trip, and we just passed through the state, as I say in the book, again, I saw nice cars and teeth, only this time I was expecting to.
Yeah. Now, you've traveled over 30,000 miles.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite site, a favorite view?
Well, the one on the cover of the book is certainly one of them. The Black Hills of South Dakota rising over the rolling plains as you drive from east to west across the western part of that state. That's another favorite site, the Front Range of the Rockies. So many things. There were many places that people often ask, what was my favorite place? And I don't have a favorite place. I have many favorite places.
Yeah.
America is full of wonderful places.
The countryside here is stunning, I think. It is just breathtaking. Now, you just mentioned South Dakota, and that's where you met your wife, isn't it? That's where you both went to college.
Well, yes, that's where she was from. She's a South Dakota girl, and I was born and raised on the East Coast in the New York metro area. I went to South Dakota, of all places, to go to school. And that's where I met Karen. She was a ticket seller at the local movie house. She was working part-time while she went to school, and that's how I met her. in South Dakota, and then we lived in South Dakota after we were married. We married right at the tail end of college, and went to Rapid City, South Dakota. It's where my first real job and her first real job were, and where our first child was born. And so we feel quite an affinity for that state, and it's one of the places I usually tell people about when they ask me about my favorites. I tell them it's where the East meets West, at the Missouri River in South Dakota, and you go from, it's a dramatic change. It's night and day. You go from the tall grass prairie on the eastern bank to the short grass prairie on the western bank. You go from cornfields to cow pastures, to the open plains. You go from tractor country to horse country, and you go from engineer caps and bib overalls to Stetson hats and high-heeled boots.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard, and I don't know because I've never been to Kansas, but I've heard that Kansas is one of the most boring states to drive through.
Well, it may be, but I wouldn't know it. That's one of the places we did not get to, and let's just say it didn't call to us on this trip.
Right. So where would you say, you just mentioned South Dakota, which obviously had a lot of diversity for you driving. On your travels, where was probably the least interesting driving for you?
Well, there were several places that weren't particularly aesthetic, and I've got to say, it's going to probably offend some people, but I've got to say that one of them was Texas.
Mm.
Texas has some beautiful places on the Gulf Coast, and it's got some wonderful people, and we spent a couple of months in the lower Rio Grande Valley Christmas and New Year's time, and thoroughly enjoyed the experience. But Texas has got a lot of very very monotonous driving. Some places in the upper Midwest were similar. The Ohio Illinois country was not too much to distinguish it from anywhere else.
Right. Yeah, and it feels as though you're not moving when the scenery doesn't change. I've been on desert drives for many hundred miles, and it's like, are we actually moving? And you may be doing like 90 miles an hour.
Yeah.
You say this was not just a journey of miles and views, but also one of personal discovery and loss. What did you learn about yourself, Robert, on this trip?
Well, that's a good question. I learned that, I'm sure you've heard this before, but for me, it was a first-time discovery, that things in your life really aren't very important. We had lived in Tacoma, Karen and I, for the last 30 years before this trip. We had a 5-room home there. We raised 3 kids there, and the kids grew up and moved away, and so we had this big house to rattle around in. And over the years, we had collected all of these things, some of which we were very important to us, cherished belongings. And came time for the trip, we sold the house and we put our things into storage at a moving company warehouse, and we moved into a fifth wheel trailer with hardly more than the clothes on our backs. You know, we had cooking gear and table settings and clothing, and that was about it. And we discovered, much to our own surprise, that we never missed the things we didn't have with us. We never thought about them, never wished they were there with us. And we discovered what little importance they are in our lives, and I think in most people's lives.
Mm. Did you have a re-entry period? I had dinner a couple of weeks ago with a videographer who's been filming out chimpanzees out at the Jane Goodall Gombe Reserve. And he said the worst thing about coming back is sensory overload. Did you find that when you came back to real life?
Well, no, I don't think so, because when we came back, we were moving into a new home that we had not occupied before in a new town, and meeting new people and just starting life over again in retirement.
So it's kind of an extension of your vacation, really.
Well,
for
yeah,
a while,
it sort of tapered off. It took a while before this felt like home. We felt like visitors here, you know, for the first few months, and so it was sort of a gradual reentry into real life.
Yeah. You talk in the book about some of the foods that you ate along the journey. Did you have, tell us about some of the food that you experienced. I mean, some of it is not, I'm trying to think of the name of it right now and I didn't write it down, but it's like a huge potato dumpling with onions and covered in gravy. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, you're talking about pierogi.
That's it.
It's like a mashed potato dumpling with melted butter and sautéed onions, sautéed until they're just sweet and soft. And, it's a delicious thing. And of course that's an ethnic food. I bought a plate of pierogi in Pennsylvania. In the coal mining country of Pennsylvania, and there's a lot of people there who eat that stuff.
Mm. What other kinds of food did you come across that were very colloquial?
Well, we ate Mexican food, of course, in Texas and Mexico and New Mexico. It was found to our surprise that in New Mexico, my goodness, they really make it hot. Karen and I have traveled extensively in Mexico, and we love the country and we love the food, but the hottest food I've ever eaten has been in New Mexico, and they load some of that stuff up with chilies to the extent where I can't eat it, and I like hot food.
Mm.
Seafood in Florida. Florida is a wonderful place for excellent seafood, and we enjoy that. And, of course, southern Louisiana, it's hard to beat that Cajun cooking.
Right. Did you come across food samples that you didn't enjoy?
Well, other than New Mexico, not really. We're pretty.
You were pretty game for everything.
Pretty open-minded about food, we enjoyed that aspect of the trip. There were parts of the country where we ate out more often than others, and one of them was Florida. Another was the Southern Appalachians. Another was the Southwest, because they had such excellent local cuisine. And then there were other places where it was less intriguing, and we would eat more at home.
Mm. Now, you just mentioned the Southern Appalachians, and you said in the book that it was hard to go anywhere there without finding a buzzload of Christians of some kind pouring out.
Yeah.
Is it really... I mean, we call it the Bible Belt, and I've never been there myself. So is it really everything is based around church out there?
Well, that's how it struck me. I think I said a busload of Baptists either arriving or departing just about everywhere you go.
That's right.
That's what you encounter. And that's how it seemed to me. I literally saw busloads of Baptists coming and going at various venues. We would go for a ride on little country roads in the Appalachians, and what impressed us was we'd be out almost in the middle of nowhere and way out in the country, way, way out, and here would be a fork in the road, and there'd be a small wooden sign with an arrow pointing up the right-hand fork, and it would tell you the name of the church up there and how many miles to it. And then you'd get to the next fork, and there'd be another arrow with the name of the church up there and how many miles to it. Meanwhile, you're going along, you're winding your way up a valley on the main road, the main little country road,
mm-hmm.
and every few miles there would be another church. And I was struck with how many churches there were and the fact that these people thought they were important enough to put on signs and tell the distance too. That impressed me.
Mm. Now, do you think people live their lives differently because of that?
Well, they live their lives differently there, I think, differently from many other places, for a lot of reasons. This was Karen and my first real visit to the Southeast, and our very first visit to the Southern Appalachians, and so everything there was brand new for us, and so many things jumped out at us. One of them was I got a strong feeling of what a watershed experience the war between the states had been for that society. No matter which side of the conflict one's antecedents might have been on, many people don't realize that in portions of the South, like Tennessee, the society was badly rent by loyalties in that war. In Tennessee, for example, the people who lived in the lowland areas and in the big agricultural areas, and of course the plantation areas, it tended to come down on the side of the Confederacy, and while the people in the mountains, in little hamlets and out in the gullies and the valleys, they tended to favor the Union, and so there was bitter feeling. Mm-hmm. and people still live with an awareness of that and fallout from it. I found, for example, a great preponderance of their historic sites seem to deal with the conflict in one way or another. I found that when I examined, for example, a local alternative newspaper or an arts publication, I'd find it generally a significant number of new books by local authors or a significant number of scheduled talks or lectures all seem to deal with one aspect or another of that conflict.
Mm. It sounds as though you really integrated into the culture.
Well, we tried to. We tried to be, be travelers and not just tourists.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another thing that really impressed the both of us. Karen and I spent one Friday morning at the U.S. Marine Corps recruit depot at Parris Island, South Carolina, and we had come to see the graduation of the Marine Corps basic trainees, and the Marine Corps graduates a class nearly every Friday at that depot. They say that 19,000 recruits a year pass through that depot where they take their boot camp, and so we're out there on a early Friday morning, and it's basically Karen and me and moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas and girlfriends of the basic trainees, and the Marines are conducting their graduation ceremony and a pass and review on the depot's outdoor parade deck, and Karen and I are sitting in the bleachers alongside the deck, and we're watching this handful of really tough looking drill instructors and several companies of very, very young Marines, and they're strutting their stuff out there in company formation, and the youngsters look just razor sharp, and it was an emotional moment for us, for Karen and me, considering what was going on in the Middle East at that moment, and what struck us was the pride on the faces of the young men, and also on the faces of their families. Mm. At a time when CNN and other networks were counting bodies halfway around the world.
Yeah. Let's take a break. We'll talk more with Robert Mottram when we come back. His book is called In Search of America's Heartbeat, 12 Months on the Road. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Trailer for sale or rent. Rooms to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes. Ah, but 2 hours of pushing broom.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Vicky St. Clair and wanted to let you know about Book Talk, a weekly podcast brought to you by Conversations Live. In Book Talk, we'll be reviewing books from the eclectic to the banned to the challenging and, of course, to the easy and fun summer beach read. You can download Book Talk podcasts at 1150kknw.com under the podcast section of the site. If you'd like to be a guest reviewer for Book Talk, call me, Vicky, at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or drop me an email at info@conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Howard Bono, the host of The Money Thing, heard right here on Tuesdays at noon. You don't need to know everything about money, but there are some things you really should know. Each week, my co-host Gary Mance and I will bring you the information that you need. We cut through all the verbiage and marketing hype to provide you with an hour of condensed, easy-to-understand information. We want to improve the quality of your life by taking the financial stress away. So join us for The Money Thing, Tuesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Talk radio with a difference. Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Man of means by no means, king of the road.
And welcome back, everyone. This is the last segment of today's show. My guest is Robert Mottram. He's an award-winning journalist and author. And together with his wife, Karen, traveled more than 30,000 miles into the far-flung corners of our nation. And I wanted to ask you, Robert, how long you and Karen have been married?
We've been married in a few days. It'll be 46 years.
Wow. Well, congratulations for that time when it comes together. Now, you two traveled very closely together for 12 months. What did you learn about each other? Did you learn anything new about each other?
Well, you know, what we learned, and this is very interesting because we had been married for more than 40 years before we began the trip. And what we learned was that we can actually get along with each other 24/7 in a small trailer without a problem, and this had loomed before us as something of a potential issue because many couples can't, we weren't sure what to expect.
Yeah, and you probably felt into like you were describing in the supermarket. You had your thing to do, Karen had her thing to do. So it sounds very much as though you worked very much as a team.
Well, we did work as a team. Before that, though, we had our separate careers and in many cases, separate interests that we pursued independently outside the home, like many couples do. And it wasn't clear to us going in how well we'd mesh on a 24/7 basis. And we found, much to our delight, that we did just fine.
Now, you're a journalist for over 30 years. Curiosity is one of the traits of being a good journalist. Did your curiosity get you into trouble at all on your travels?
Yeah, no, you know, curiosity didn't get me into trouble at all. In fact, we had no trouble on our travels. We were impressed by the people we met, the friendliness of people. I don't recall a single bad experience with individual people on the entire trip.
Mm. Did you take notes as you went along, or you talked into a tape recorder?
Talked into a tape recorder, Vicky, and that came from my days in professional journalism. Mm. And I find that you take notes much more extensively on a tape recorder than you do on a notepad. And also, you don't have to stop what you're doing to take those notes. You can continue to drive or to hike or whatever your activity is.
Right. Now, you mentioned before that you realized how unimportant material things were. I want to ask you what kind of things you worried about before you left and versus when you came back.
You mean in life in general?
Yeah, in life in general. How maybe your mindset changed about, you know, worrying? Because we all worry about different things.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure we worried a whole lot before we left.
Well, that's good.
I'm not sure we worry a whole lot now. We sort of take it as it comes, but it was a relief to find that that the things aren't important. As many people do if they reach a certain stage of life, I watched my parents downsize in the latter stages of their lives as they moved into smaller places and they gave up so many cherished things, and I watched that process and I felt so bad for them, and I looked ahead in my life and Karen's life, and thought, well, someday we'll be doing that too. I wonder how we'll be able to deal with such a sad thing. And I discovered it's not such a sad thing. Those things aren't that important.
Right. You talk about your father in the book. In the book, I should say that you weave through there some history in a most interesting way. I mean, because history can be boring to some folks, but you presented it in a very interesting way. And you also weave through it there some of the story about your father who had Alzheimer's. And one of the things you say in there as being one of your biggest regrets is that you didn't listen to him as well as you wished you had. Tell us about the lesson in that and what we can learn from it.
Well, the lesson I learned from it was that you just need to pay attention. You need to pay attention. And my dad was a very high-powered guy. He was a business executive, worked on Wall Street during his career. He was an officer of several corporations. He was well-educated and highly intelligent and quite a guy. And it began to become obvious when he was in his late 70s that he was beginning to slip. And I refused to accept that. I refused to believe it. And
It's hard, though. It is hard when you see a parent a certain way. It's hard to accept that, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought a man of his intelligence could never. His mother had succumbed to Alzheimer's, and I witnessed that when I was a boy of 11 or 12, and so it wasn't totally unexpected that Dad contracted that, but I thought that a man of his intellect would be able to fight it. And of course, I came to the truth that nobody can fight it. It's an insidious disease. It's a disease that, without exception, takes not only your life but also your dignity.
Mm. So
and it's a widespread thing. As some I discovered as part of my research when I sat down to write the book, some 4.5 million American families are undergoing the Alzheimer's experience at any given moment.
Right. We actually did a show on it just a few weeks ago on Alzheimer's. It was staggering, the numbers. One of your favorite places, you say, was Savannah, Georgia. Tell us what that is like, because it sounds wonderful. I've never been there either.
Well, Savannah, Georgia, we lucked out, and not through any superior planning, but just by chance, we happened to arrive there at the height of the azalea season, and there are tens of thousands of azalea plants all over Savannah, and it's the most beautiful city. These big trees that interlace their branches over the streets, and Spanish moss that hangs from the branches, and like tinsel on a Christmas tree, and these acres and acres and acres of beautiful azaleas everywhere, and beautifully restored homes, centuries old homes of brick. It's just a lovely place, and every few blocks in the downtown area, there's a small square of grass and trees and azaleas, and the road splits and goes around. You have to go around the square. You can't go through it, and 4 or 5 blocks farther on, here's another one, then another one, another one, and they're in every direction. And it's just the most beautiful place.
Mm. Are the people there as friendly as they're made out to be? Because everything I've read about the place, the people just exude this southern charm.
Yeah, we found the people to be friendly, although I was kind of influenced by the book Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which I read before I got there. And the author of that had some things to say about Savannah society that you probably wouldn't want to adopt, in your own neck of the woods.
But, yeah, that's actually one of my favorite movies with John Cusack and Kevin Spacey.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Uh-huh.
Has your perception of this country changed?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure my perception has changed as much as the country has come into focus. And one of the things that I found, one of the things I was hoping to find, and I found it much to my delight, is that this country is still not that much of a homogenized place, in spite of television and in spite of the internet. We have these wonderful, beautiful regional differences, and it's not differences only in diet and in accent, but it's differences in outlook, in people, the way people perceive the world and interact with it, and I find that so delightful. I was born in the New York metro area and raised there, and I've lived and worked in New York and northern New England and the Dakotas and Pacific Northwest and California and Alaska, and I found that I think experiencing life in so many places has attuned me to cultural nuance, and so I love to see how people live in different areas and to see how their environments affect their lifestyle. And I found that people may essentially be the same at heart. People are people, but they don't live the same. They don't behave the same, and their outlook on life and their view of the world are not the same. And sometimes the differences are subtle, but they're significant, and they're just fascinating.
Well, that's heartwarming to hear, because I do worry about that with, we see Walmarts going up everywhere and, mm-hmm. It does seem that we are becoming more and more homogenized. Mm-hmm. So it's very heartwarming to hear that you did not find that. I'm of the belief that home is where the heart is. I know you live in Anacortes now, but do you have a spot that you consider home, or is it Anacortes?
Well, I have a very warm place in my heart for Tacoma. I lived there for 30 years, and Tacoma was very good to me and to Karen. It'll always hold a special place with me. I'm very happy in Anacortes. The people here are just wonderful, and the country is gorgeous. So we're right at the jumping off place to the San Juan Islands, and we have so much water so many trees, and we live just minutes from one of the most beautiful spots I think on the planet, and that's Deception Pass.
Oh, I would agree with you. Yeah,
yeah.
Beautiful.
And every time I go over that bridge, I have to catch my breath.
Mm.
It's just that gorgeous.
Yeah, I always have to stop and walk on it.
Yeah.
Look down. Yeah. Well, Robert Mudgham, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. In 30 seconds, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Oh, my goodness. I'd like to leave them with the thought that they can do a trip like this, and they can enjoy it as much as we did. And I think they'll find, as we did, that a year is much too short a time. Karen and I traveled more than 30,000 miles, and yet we barely scratched the surface of the land.
Huh, interesting. I saw on the end of the book you ran into somebody who'd been doing it for 16 years and still had not seen everywhere.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. My guest, Robert Mottram, award-winning journalist and author, and his book is called In Search of America's Heartbeat, 12 Months on the Road. And you can find out more about Robert at www.rvacrosstheusa.com. That's rvacrosstheusa.com. You can link to that from my site at conversationslive.net. And Robert has quite a bit of information up there about what you want to do if you're planning a trip. So take a look and check it out. Thanks to everyone for tuning in today. Don't forget to check out Book Talk, our weekly book review podcasts. You can find those at 1150kknw.com. Thanks to Eric Ryder for keeping us going through our technical glitches today. And we will see you next Monday at noon for more Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Until then, live well, live strong.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, naturalist, adventurer, and essayist Craig Childs. People magazine describes his new book as a quietly seductive ode to the power of mindfulness. And the New York Times Book Review declares Childs a modern-day desert father who responds to nature with religious awe. Tune in next Monday at noon for the Animal Dialogues, Uncommon Encounters in the Wild, right here on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. You can find more show details at conversationslive.net.